Hello, and welcome to the Burning Issue podcast, which looks at how the UK deals with its black bag waste. My name is Luke Walsh, and I am the editor of the news website endswasteandbioenergy.com, which looks at the performance of the UK and Europe's energy from waste market. Traditionally, the UK focused on dumping its waste in landfills, but over the past decade, in the UK in particular, has moved to energy from waste. Development of these facilities is obviously a massive job, and I've spoken in previous episodes to people who make the choices of where and when to build these facilities. But in this episode, I'm talking to a company which works down the supply chain and actually supplies the pipework to facilities. So for anyone who's never been to an EFW plant, when you walk into one, basically all you really see are pipes going everywhere. So to find out more, I'm talking to Harry Stark, who is the Managing Director of Silka UK. He's been involved in delivering some of the best EFW projects in the UK and abroad. However, he's also been involved in EFW projects that go wrong, and I want to talk to him about how this impacts on you as a person and as a business. So let's hear what he has to say. Hello, Harry. Thank you very much for joining me.
Hi, Luke. You're welcome.
For anyone listening who doesn't know about Silka UK, what are you all about?
The group is headquartered in Austria, technically a German company because that's where all our product development is and all the central departments. Silka Group comprises approximately 20 companies. Most of them are European-based, but there's one in the USA and one in Australia outside Europe. And we're a manufacturer of pipe supports. We develop the products. We make them through our very unique supply chain.
From my perspective, a lot of projects that are in the EFW and bioenergy sector owned by people in the UK, but lots of the suppliers into that come from the EU. I guess you also come from the EU, but you've got a big presence in the UK. Do you feel you're an exception in the sector, dealing with projects here as well as projects, like you said, in the Middle East, Poland and Australia?
Big presence is perhaps a little bit of an exaggeration because we are technically an SME. We employ 30 plus people in the UK, which for a niche supplier like us is relatively good because we don't do much else than the things that we're talking about here today. We do it perhaps for other projects outside the energy from waste markets, but pipe support is a niche discipline. As far as UK versus Europe is concerned, I can only respond here as an individual because I follow your publications and the general publications on the energy from waste sector because it's important to us. You have more than 500 incinerators in Europe and you've got about 50 here. And the 50 that we've got here, most of them have actually just emerged since the millennium, whereas the ones in Europe had mainly been there already in the year 2000. And therefore, of course, the historic technology comes from the continent. I believe that this is the reason why most companies involved in building these plants are from Europe. And that we are also from Europe, that's more a coincidence because it was only through the UK search of projects that we gained an interest in these projects and have now become kind of a specialist for that niche element.
I don't want you to sell yourself short. The plants wouldn't work without the piping aspect. If anyone doesn't know, could you explain a bit more about how the piping bits work for energy from waste plants?
Let's just start from scratch. When we're talking about pipe supports, obviously to an audience that would normally not have a great deal of interest in it, you need pipe work in all kinds of projects. And let's say, for example, something like an airport hangar is one end of the scale. That would be the most simplistic big project that would require some utility piping and pipe supports, which is the element that connects the piping with the projects or with the building structure, whatever you want to call it, would then be highly repetitive. And in comparison to the volumetrics of an airport hangar, it would be a very, very small thing. So the other end of the scale is basically waste incinerators. And that's simply because you've got a very, very small footprint and it is full of pipework. You open the door and pipework is what you see all around. It's more a machine than a construction project. That makes, for a company like us, energy from waste incinerators possibly the most challenging and also most exciting project because you simply have so much pipework of different purpose and temperatures within a very, very small volumetric space.
A lot of the plants are built close to residential areas or in a set industrial area, so you haven't got the space to move around. HZI has seemingly become the dominant force in developing EFW plants, especially in the UK. How do you interact with other businesses in the sector?
Quite well. When we started the journey of engaging in this type of plant, the market, as you may remember, I don't know, how long have you been doing this, Luke?
I've been doing this particular site for 10 years, about 20 years reporting on the news, so quite a while.
In terms of energy from waste, we share something, because it was also around about 12 years that we started having an interest in these projects, and there wasn't this dominance of HZI that you just referred to. Yeah, it wasn't an equal distribution between them and KNIM and Volund in Denmark. But since then, we know it's become the dominant force. But we're doing our best to diversify. First of all, it's not just incinerators that we're interested in. We're also engaging in the biogas and anaerobic digestion markets. It's a different kind of package that we're supplying for that. And then also within thermal waste treatment itself, there are a few other players. The Spanish company, I mean, look, they have different backgrounds, but what matters to us is, do they need pipework specified, delivered or not? Whatever their background is, from what angle they are approaching it. We're pretty good at that.
Obviously, the Spanish company is Anciona, isn't it? They're building the Edmonton plant. Maybe more people will come in.
They are basically a construction company. They would also build bridges and hospitals, whereas HZI are a technology specialist. They take the responsibility for partly the same things and make both companies in the relevant projects the decision maker that we need to convince, but they look at the whole thing in completely different ways.
Because one of them's coming at it from a construction side and one of it's coming from the energy from waste side.
Exactly. The EPC market is actually a funny piece of evolution, I would say, because when you look at EPCs in any industry, most of them started with just one element of the projects that they now do turnkey. It's always the same story. You are involved in projects, you do a little bit, and then you are asked by your client, can you do this, can you do that? Sometimes without your own ambition initially, you end up doing lots of more things than what you started with. Then it's just a few small pieces of the jigsaw, and then you're on EPC if you've got the money in the bank. And that's what we also find in energy from waste markets. So it's at the end of the day, it's the balance sheet that determines whether people trust you to build such a thing, and then you need the expertise. And as soon as you've got 70% expertise, you can buy in the 30% and do the whole thing.
You mentioned the EPC market there. Other people on this podcast have said maybe we're getting to the end of the pipeline, but there's a few projects still looking to move to financial close and construction. How do you see it here in the UK?
Are you referring to the market being saturated of the plants?
I wouldn't say the market's saturated, but I would say from talking to people like yourselves and others in the sector that it's getting to the point where there's maybe five or six more plants to be built, and then the market might move to more refurbishment of existing facilities.
I can only tell you what my gut feeling is. I mentioned earlier, there is so many more plants in European countries compared to the UK. I mean, there was hardly any plant, actually. In the grand scheme of things, let's be honest, by the millennium, the UK in proportion to the population of then, what was it, 65 million, had no real incinerator capacity. And all of that just happened during the last 20 years for a few reasons. I think the country is growing. There's far more waste being produced, growing population, and then still a far smaller number of plants than in European countries. So from a plausibility perspective as an individual, I cannot see this market being saturated. It just doesn't make sense to me. Why should it stop when we just have 50, 60 plants in the UK and France or Germany have more than 100?
We're still landfilling waste, aren't we? And energy from waste is a better solution than landfill. So you could argue, therefore, that we could need another 40 plants.
I mean, that's for political decisions. Yeah, but talking about political decisions, I remember we had more than 10 years ago when we were still exporting product to Australia through Felixstowe, an invitation from the port. And one of my logistics people went to Felixstowe. They got a tour. And the most exciting takeaway that she came back with was the revelation that the biggest single freight volume that Felixstowe at the time handled was black sack waste to China. And that was simply because there is such a surplus, I presume that's still the case, of empty container capacity that have to go back. Because we're not exporting, of course, as much to China as we're importing from them. And therefore, it was economically viable to put our black sack waste to China. And what they do with the black sack waste, you better don't want to know that. So I think this is something that is politically not desired anymore. There is a lot of waste that the UK got rid of in other dodgy ways, I would say, that needs to be handled. And landfill is not an option anymore, as you know.
the reverse logistics are still how most of the waste aggregators operate. And I think there's still between 1 and 1.5 million tons being exported to treatment, mainly in Europe now. That could be dealt with here if there were more plants. If there was a market for it, it would be dealt with here.
It's interesting, isn't it? We're exporting it to Europe with full customs procedure. Can you imagine that?
Maybe we'll talk a bit about Brexit later. You've also behind a number of biomass-fired builds, and these plants mostly take a waste wood feedstock, a feedstock that's becoming harder to source. Does that technology make any difference to how you work on the plant compared to an energy from waste facility?
I mean, look, it's very flattering to say we're behind them, yeah. I mean, we're a little bit involved in them, so we're not behind biomass plants. But what I have to say here is that at the end of the day, for a company like us to provide a special niche discipline, all that matters is there a boiler, is there a turbine, do I have some decent balance of plant pipe work in between them? As long as that's the case, I don't care what the fuel is. From the perspective of a supplier like Sikla, it doesn't matter whether it's a dry black sack waste incineration or wet biomass. I would say from the experience we've made so far that it's the technical challenge, the logistical challenge, and also how many you could possibly use within your learning curve. Because that's what you need in order to make it a profitable business. You need actually quite a lot of these plants because they are far more complicated from the perspective of someone like us than very simple projects, if that makes sense.
That does make perfect sense. You've talked about how the UK's developed over the last 20 years and the 12 years while you've been working here. One of the projects you were on was the ferry bridge to facilities, if I'm right, which is the largest UK site on its own. What was it like working on ferry bridge, on the ferry bridge plants, I should say?
I remember that although we actually started engaging in that market back in 2013, I think the first projects we had, I know that the first projects we did was the STV2 in Cleveland, UK, the one that has this 1980s facade. I found that fascinating.
Yeah, the Suez one.
I was wondering, why would they build in 2012 a project with a 1980s design? And that was the duplication of a plant that was already there. It's one that's blue, white, and red, I think.
Yeah.
One dirty blue, white, and red one, and then a shiny new one next to it. And the answer why it wasn't the typical architecture that you find these days that almost looks like an airport terminal, yeah, was simply that it's such an awful area. Well, if they would have built a state-of-the-art architecture for their plant, it would have made everything else looking even worse. So that was the first project we got involved with. And funnily enough, because your question was about Ferry Bridge, during that time, Ferry Bridge 1 was already in the planning. And when we got finally involved, it was too late for us to get specified, but we then got encouraged to engage directly with the contractors. And it was historically the last opportunity we had to do these projects with the subcontractor. And it is still, to me, the proof that it is right not doing it that way, but working directly with the companies who are behind the technology. It was a very bumpy thing, the Ferry Bridge one. And Ferry Bridge 2 was quite interesting in a different way, because there was a new approach being tested. And it is worth noting that someone like us within the context of such a project is fair game, simply because we're not permanently on site. And in a construction project, you always need somebody to blame when something goes wrong. The easiest one to be blamed is the one who isn't there. And there was at the time a contractor involved who got sort of forced to use our products. They didn't like that. And therefore, whenever something went wrong, it was Sikla's fault. It was a very stressful time, I have to say. In the end, we got there and we could sort of put the record straight. It's nothing that I remember with a great deal of delight.
You don't remember it fondly?
No.
You talked a lot about the architecture stuff there, and I'm sure obviously other parts of the Northeast have great architecture. One of the plants you've worked on was the Amager Buck facility in Copenhagen, and that's got a ski slope on it. What was it like working on a facility with that kind of design concept?
It didn't make a big difference, to be honest, and with the ski slope thing, it took me a while to understand how that's actually working. Yeah, so apparently it's an artificial ski slope. So because first when I saw the imagery and the computer animations, I thought it's a real ski slope, and that didn't really make sense to me. Do you know, is that a success?
It opened just before COVID, so they had to close it. But then because it's outside, they seem to be getting people through. I have a friend who lives in Copenhagen and he's been to it. It's a tourist attraction now.
Normally, Denmark wouldn't be our purview from a cycler group perspective. But what happened was that, as I said earlier, Vølund was 10 years ago still a formidable player in the UK market. And we had really good success with them initially. They tested our approach in a smaller project, which was also in Denmark. And again, like with Ferry Bridge, this skiing slope facility, which also was quite big.
I think it's 450,000, isn't it? Yeah.
So that had been planned already. So there wasn't anything for us where we could convince them to specify us, because specification had been finished. But what happened, the way this traditionally works with the pipe supports, contractors are using traditional steel. When I say traditional steel, you have to think of a double flanged beam or a parallel flange steel or something like that. And this is simply because you've got quite significant forces involved when the pipework is hot, which it is in thermal facilities. The usual 3D software that contractors are using during the design phase has what's called a steelwork design module. And that offers you all the generic steel structures with all the structural data. And what the designers basically do is picking the correct sections for the correct forces and then specifying the way it has to be welded. And then this can be sent out to a number of companies, local fabricators, who would receive what is called the pipe support book. And against that book, they would fabricate that. There's one big problem here, which is that it can only be done against the virtual reality. You simply cannot wait until the project is ready and then go in and measure everything. So you have to have a certain degree of reliability that the computer model is approximately what you face on site. I mean, you've got building tolerances, of course, but there is a certain degree of experience. But the truth is, because the traditional steel is an extremely accurate specification and fabrication process where holes have to be in the right position, that bolts can be received in the right position, etc., etc., it has to be right. And there is, of course, a certain discrepancy. And I know from our clients, it is usually around about 10% plus. So what it means is you fabricate, let's say, 100 pipe supports against the computer model, and you would expect 10 of them to be fabricated again, simply because they weren't right. It is economically usually not viable, because it's very difficult to change a product that's fully coated, has holes in the wrong position, is usually more expensive than making the whole thing again. Coming back to Amager Buck, so what happened was that the contractor who had fabricated against that virtual reality, they did a large lot of pipe support against the wrong revision of the model. And I still have photos on the server that show an entire courtyard outside the skiing slope facility with hundreds of supports that all had to be scrapped because they couldn't be used, because something was fundamentally wrong with that revision.
Ooh.
People use cycler because it's more state of the art, so it saves weight, it's more adjustable, more adaptable, etc. They then came to us and said, look, we haven't got the time to do this again because it takes so many weeks. And we were then in this position that although people were already on site in high visibility vests installing pipework, all these supports that couldn't be used had to be translated into our system and then fabricated, delivered again. It's not sustainable. We couldn't work like this each time. If we would work like this each time, we would have to employ 5 times more people than we do, and it would not be an economically attractive proposition anymore. So that's basically what our experience was.
You were also on the Port Clarence project. So that was the same builder, and that was the steel structure issue, and that project never finished. So I wanted to ask you about projects that go, because the two projects you mentioned, Ferry Bridge and Amalgamback, had delays, but Port Clarence couldn't complete. So what's it like when a project doesn't work and it's not your fault?
It's terrible, to be honest. I've been very humble in terms of downplaying the significance of what Sigler does in these plants. But actually, as far as those projects are concerned, pipe supports were indeed a significant contributor to the delay. And we're talking the same contractor here. What happened was that when we had our first discussions with them in Copenhagen, Glostrup, or where they are, they were very proud of having been a company that basically sticks to their guns and always does the two projects a year, and very proudly told us that they always do everything in-house. And that made it so smooth at the beginning, because we were talking to people who had been with Volund for many, many years and approached it calmly, implemented our product into the relevant E3D software, which was PDMS at the time. And it worked well. But what then happened was, and I think it's possibly because of this UK market that suddenly became crazy with all the projects, that they left this track. They suddenly took on more than the two projects a year. And I remember that what you just mentioned, the Port Clarence, that was part of a package that they internally referred to at the time as 3+1. So that was three biomass plants. I think the other ones were called Temple Borer and Teesside. And then you had plus one was one traditional waste incinerator in Scotland, Dunbar. What we observed as a supplier was that this proudly expressed philosophy to do everything in-house, it couldn't work anymore because they simply had too much in the order book, and they did something that they had no experience with, which was outsourcing. So within a short period of time, they hired a lot of new people, and they also suddenly had to work with design contractors. In order to be competitive with detailed design, you have to go far away. At the time, they went to Poland. I'm not sure whether that's still competitive today because Polish wages have increased significantly. But they did. And the problem wasn't really the Polish design contractor. The problem was that the principal contractor had no experience with the outsourcing of that package. And this is when it all went completely pear-shaped. And we ended up, believe it or not, Little Sigler and Milton Keynes had people from Volund in our offices for several weeks sometimes, just to make sure that the stuff is done against the latest revision and on time, etc. Because the problem is this, you have to have it right when it's on site. If I may reveal one success factor of HZI, I don't say any more because otherwise I'm going to be in trouble. What they fully understood is that advanced detailing is what makes this a success. And it means that the opposite would be not detailing enough, leaving too much to chance. And that's exactly what happened with Port Clarence and Co., which was simply that many details hadn't been done and had to be stick built on site. And that's actually when this usually becomes messy.
It's a story in so many other industries, isn't it? A company is successful, expands too far, falls apart.
Look, it's the density of services, services meaning the mechanical, electrical services. These are very small volumetric building structures with such a massive density of pipework and electrical cable trays. It is almost like the difference between opening the bonnet of a old Fiat 500 or a Porsche, yeah, where you open it and there's hardly any space for any more. That's basically what it is. The problems in terms of execution happen when companies conceive energy from waste incinerators as construction projects and apply the usual blame culture. Because in normal construction projects, unfortunately, you still have the situation that people believe by just shouting at one another and asking for more men, they can solve anything. But this is not how it works when you have no space and extremely high fines to pay when you can't hand over on time with these 24/7 operation plants. Therefore, I think the secret is detailing as much as you can, building it really like a machine.
to be honest, Harry, I could talk to you all day about things that have gone wrong and things that have gone right. Bring it back to the modern day. I just wanted to ask you, we're a few years into Brexit now. You've got a different experience of it, not coming from the UK originally. How do you see trading with the EU going for us now in the terms of energy from waste?
I don't know. I mean, at least it's been recognized that it's been the wrong path, I would say. It's the elephant in the room, isn't it? I mean, politicians haven't yet understood that it's something that they could easily raise. They're just afraid of the electorate. They are afraid of touching something that would, again, stir division. But I've lived in this country for more than 20 years. The mentality was alien to me when Brexit came up in the first place. But there was one guy, and I forgot the name, he was somebody who explained it to the Europeans, and he said, if you ask British people for Brexit, that's like asking kids for chocolate. Sort of mental thing here in play that is very hard for people like me to understand, but I accept them and I respect them. But the thing is, everything that those who knew said is going to go wrong has gone wrong. And the amount of paperwork that we have to deal with just to get our European manufactured product into the country is just mind-boggling. It's ridiculous. But the funny thing is, and this is the silver lining, because we're here in a podcast on energy from waste, I believe that has actually fueled that industry, because I think you mentioned earlier that there's also a lot of waste being exported to European plants. And I think I read once in one of your publications that it's got to do with Italy or Germany or France having far more recycling. So it means that the mix of black sack waste isn't as incinerable as it is here, because there is lots of stuff has been taken out already. The fact that you can't simply send it to Europe anymore and makes us sort of being here with all the waste that we used to send to them and now can't anymore. That is possibly, you as a journalist must know better than me, it's probably one of the factors why plants that had been on the back burner for so long, take Rivenhall, for example, suddenly got approved, because there's high pressure to get rid of the waste.
Yeah, I mean, it does make sense. A lot of plants did get approved post-Brexit and did move to financial close just after it. And if there's a silver lining of Brexit, maybe it is that those projects got completed. We're almost at the end now. So there's one thing I wanted to ask you. Your background was in tools. It's like energy from waste. It's perhaps not the sexiest industry for young people to go into. Do you feel that the manufacturing, the industrial side, the tool side is creating people that want to come into the industry like yourself now?
I'm in my 50s, and I remember that when I was 16 and had to take a decision how I actually launched my career, I had no idea what to do. And I think my dad was the one who actually said, you need to do this. This is something that will always be needed. And my concept of tool making, I thought of a hammer and a drill. Unless you are from this metal fabricating industry, you would think a tool is something like that. But what it actually means is really very complex mechanical devices that would produce a car door, for example, or a bathtub within a second. So basically, it's tools as big as a small bedroom, where a metal sheet is being fed through, and then it produces a shape and cutouts, etc., etc. So that's usually something that a team of tool makers do together, like a construction project. And that's how I used to work at the beginning of my career. So therefore, I would disagree. It is something actually quite exciting, and we live in times of labor shortages, and I believe that it's something that is especially very, very exciting for anyone who's technically interested, whether boy or girl. And the industry just has to promote it. And there's so much computer technology these days that makes it even more exciting. We did CNC already more than 30 years ago, but I'm sure that this has made it more exciting in terms of all the virtual reality opportunities that you've got today and that we didn't have at the time.
We've had two positive discussions there after some not so positive things about the industry, so I like it. At the end of this podcast, the question I ask everyone to try and cover the bases is, what's the question I should have asked you and how would you have answered it?
I mean, at the end of it, I still don't understand why you would invite someone like me, Luke, you know.
Don't sell yourself short.
The question you should have asked is, what's the point of using us?
You've given me a very interesting insight into what it's like to be on these sites. So I really appreciate it. And I think it's been really interesting. So I'd say that is the point for me.
I think, honestly, that the clients of all walks of construction projects, they want to basically achieve two things, which is finishing the project within budget and within the timeline. And I think with Energy for Waste, I said it before, it is even more important because there's a lot of money at stake if it can't be handed over on time. And I believe that we as Sikla, because it's such an important link between the building structure and all these services that have to be fitted in there, we can help clients to achieve these two major objectives, finishing on time and within budget.
And finishing on time and within budget, that's a good way for us to end our talk today. Thank you very much, Harry, for joining me.
You're welcome. Thanks, Luke.
All that's left for me to say is thank you very much for listening. If you've liked what you've heard, please share it amongst your networks, either online or in person. It's all really appreciated. And if you want to learn more about the business of energy recovery, go to the website endswasteandbioenergy.com, where you can sign up for our free newsletters or even take out a subscription, if you want. Goodbye.